Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
On a Wednesday morning, it's June 17th. Great to be with you in the middle of the week on a Wednesday and every day here at EWTN's Catholic Connection. Coming your way today, very important topics we'll be discussing, including the fact that June is Internet Safety Month. And we're going to be talking to Donna Rice Hughes right out of the gate after the news and the weather. And she's the president and CEO of Enough is Enough, and she works to protect children online and families. And she's also going to tell us about some new technology, good technology, to help families make a difference in terms of social media scrolling and content and all that good stuff. We'll also, or bad stuff, whatever the case may be, we will take a look at the United Kingdom's recent social media ban for teens under 16, children under 16. That was announced earlier this week. They joined Canada, they joined Australia, and I believe Spain has done this as well. We'll talk about that with Donna Rice Hughes. Shrines and Wonders Wednesday, as always, at the bottom of the hour, 28 minutes past the hour, based on my EWTN book, the first volume of Italy's Shrines and Wonders, and of course the second volume, which came out yesterday on St. Francis. So this morning, you're going to get a kick out of this, but it really happens in many places, especially in areas that produce a lot of wine, which is pretty much every region of Italy, because they all have their own wines from various parts. But they have this race, and in the summertime, there's all kinds of really fun and very unique festivals. And this one is called the Palio di Botti. Botti means barrel in Italian, and palio actually means flag or banner, more commonly referred to as a particular race. Now, this one is just really, I would say, creative and making use of empty, large wine barrels that can weigh up to 200 pounds, depending on the size. And the ones that are used in the race in the town that is next to our little village, they're quite large. And they have these races all across Italy, especially in Tuscany, even down on the Amalfi Coast and here in Umbria. And they tie it in with other events, medieval events. And so we'll talk about that and the history behind it. And it's quite something to watch, because in our village, the main village outside of our tiny, tiny town, which only has like 100 people, they actually have to put barricades up all along the streets to keep people safe. And then we'll also talk a little bit about St. Francis in relationship to peace, based on the recently released, as recently as yesterday, book, Italy Shrines and Wonders, Volume 2 on St. Francis. And then we'll stay in Italy and talk to Joan Lewis, get the latest from Rome. That is our first hour, so Joan will join us as she always does at 39 minutes past the hour. Second hour of the program, after the news and weather, I want you to listen to this letter that was written to a doctor, I guess if you could call him that, by a woman. Her name is Claire Abernathy, and she's a detransitioner, and she is speaking out very loudly and very strongly regarding what happened to her. And she wrote a very powerful open letter to this doctor, whose name is William Allen Dullen, and she did it on the anniversary of her mastectomy. And it's heartbreaking, but it's very well written, and it's also, I think, very eye-opening. And there was an interview that she did, a brief interview that she did with Fox News. We're trying to get that for you and play that along with reading you this letter. And then we're also going to take a look at how much of this is now coming to light. Really, I think the dam started to break a few years ago when there were some folks who worked at this detransitioning, or actually transitioning, so-called clinic in Great Britain, and described exactly what this young American woman is describing. She says she only met with the so-called medical team for 15 minutes. And there were all kinds of other issues going on in her life, and they never got to the bottom of it before deciding, making this decision about this drastic surgery. And this is what happened over in Great Britain, where these whistleblowers were saying, well, wait a minute, we're supposed to be helping these kids. Aren't we supposed to listen to them and find out what's going on? Maybe it's something else that's bothering them. And they blew the whistle, and that particular facility closed down temporarily, but there's still some issues going on with that in the country overseas. But much to discuss. We'll talk about that in 2 cents. And then we're going to take a look at Eucharistic Adoration, which two wonderful priests have written books about the topic. They're in studio at EW10. We'll have two segments with Father Ignatius Schweitzer and Father Jesse Mangott on Eucharistic Adoration. Busy Wednesday. I do hope you can stay tuned for the entire 2 hours, the second hour, of course, on EWTN's Radio Extra. Weather-wise, we've got some real issues across the country, especially with rainfall. Excessive rainfall and potentially tropical cyclone-type weather in the south. along with severe thunderstorms expected in the middle part of the country. Excessive rainfall, the National Weather Service is saying, could produce locally considerable flash flooding over parts of the northwestern Gulf Coast, the lower Mississippi River, and deep south through Thursday. And they're also saying potential tropical cyclone is available to happen. One is forecast to become a tropical storm, Arthur, as it moves along or just off the northwestern coast of the Gulf through Wednesday. An outbreak of severe weather is also forecast for today, Wednesday, in the Midwest. So a lot to consider with the weather as well as the news, but let's get started with the news right now. It is 5 minutes past the hour already here on EWTN's Catholic Connection. Let's get started. Federal law enforcement officials say multiple people have now been taken into custody after discussing plans to attack the UFC event at the White House. One of those arrested is from Ohio, where the governor, Mike DeWine, says the news should serve as a reminder to stay vigilant.
Look, we live in difficult times, and there are people out there who are inclined and capable of doing very bad things.
According to a criminal complaint, the young man from Ohio, 19-year-old Tyson Proper, was arrested in Knox County and faces four criminal counts, including attempted murder of an officer or employee of the U.S. The plot is believed to have involved using drones and a gunman to cause harm at the event on Sunday. The FBI and Secret Service reportedly uncovered the plans and messages between the suspects. Meanwhile, the FBI is saying a worried mother's tip was the key factor in stopping an alleged plot to attack the USC Freedom event on Sunday. According to court documents, the mother of the 19-year-old Ohio suspect became alarmed after noticing several things, including her son's online communications with strangers, his spending of about $3,000 of his graduation money on ballistic armor plates, a shotgun, and large quantities of ammunition, and researching locations near the nation's capital and receiving maps and images via text and Discord. She then contacted police. When officers visited, his father told them their son had been meeting online with others and planned to leave for the weekend of June 13th. Meanwhile, Daniel Martindale has more on the two men from Southern California who are facing charges in connection with that alleged terror plot. He has the details.
Brian Omar Roa and Michael Allen Thomas from Riverside County are facing federal conspiracy to commit murder charges. Both men made their initial court appearances on Monday in Riverside. The FBI says they are planning to use explosive-laden drones and snipers to assassinate political leaders at UFC Freedom 250. Authorities confirm a multi-agency law enforcement operation successfully neutralized the threat of a large-scale attack. A federal criminal complaint says Roa and Thomas were reported to the FBI by a 19-year-old co-conspirator from Ohio. I'm Daniel Martindale.
President Trump suggesting a deal between the U.S. and Iran can survive even if Israel continues its attack on Lebanon. The president shared the comments while speaking from the G7 in France yesterday, but he rejected the loss of innocent lives. When asked if the deal can survive, President Trump said it can, but Israel is fighting Hezbollah too long and too many people are being killed. His comments coming as tensions with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rise due to the attacks in Lebanon, but Netanyahu has insisted on targeting Iran-backed Hezbollah. However, the president says Netanyahu has to be more responsible with respect to Lebanon. And Mark Mayfield tells us Democrats and even some Republicans are expressing skepticism about the U.S.-Iran framework agreement set to be signed on Friday.
Most of the concern from Republicans surrounds reports that claim the U.S. will send funds to Iran, but Vice President J.D. Vance says that's not true.
Not a single cent of American money under any circumstance, no matter what the Iranians do, goes to Iran.
Vance says the agreement does allow Iran to reach peaceful benchmarks, which would then allow other countries in the region to invest in Iranian infrastructure. Vance adds the agreement does state Iran must never develop or buy a nuclear weapon. His boss, President Trump, insists that it's a good deal that will open the Strait of Hormuz and stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon as further negotiations are scheduled after the signing. I'm Mark Mayfield.
Meanwhile, some lawmakers in Congress are saying they still have not been briefed on that deal. U.S. Senator of Iowa and chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, says lawmakers so far are not aware of the terms.
It would be better, from my point of view, if we had had it in our hands yesterday. And I don't see a reason why we haven't had. We have not been briefed on it. We haven't been told that we're going to have a briefing.
Senator Johnny Ayers released a statement saying a deal of this magnitude deserves thorough review. It's critical the Senate has the opportunity to examine the details. And asked about the recent agreement between the U.S. and Iran, the Pope said, thank God there is at least this memorandum, but they will officially sign on Friday. He said there will be several points to be established, but it is always better to do so through dialogue, negotiation, rather than returning to war. The Holy Father expressing his hope that the memorandum might be truly a solution to the war, that the war is really over, and that we can move forward for the good of all. Eliminate nuclear weapons, yes, seek the good of all peoples, and seek how to solve those problems, also at the economic and social levels that have been created in this time. Linda Bordoni tells us that the joint declaration signed in Geneva is calling for an end to the use of artificial intelligence and military targeting operations.
The statement, endorsed by 226 organizations and experts, including the World Council of Churches, urges technology companies and governments to stop supplying AI systems used in the military kill chain and to ensure that AI technologies do not contribute to violations of international humanitarian law or human rights. The declaration was presented during a UN meeting on artificial intelligence in the military domain held in Geneva this week. It comes in the wake of Pope Leo XIV's encyclical Magnifica Humanitas and his appeal for the world to disarm AI. The signatories warn that AI is increasingly being used to accelerate warfare, enabling military operations to be carried out more quickly and on a larger scale. They argue that such systems risk undermining human responsibility in life and death decisions and could make it more difficult to identify accountability when violations of international law occur. Particular concern is expressed over the use of large language models and other AI tools to generate and prioritize military targets. According to the declaration, these technologies may weaken compliance with the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution that lie at the heart of international humanitarian law.
Republican Governor Mike DeWine, who has repeatedly postponed executions over the past 7 years, saying yesterday that Ohio should abolish the death penalty, confirming his change of heart on the policy he helped write as a state legislature 45 years ago. The 79-year-old said during a news conference that information indicates a death penalty is not serving as a deterrent to violent crime, which he had always believed was its moral imperative. He added, I don't believe that argument today can be successfully made, nor do I believe that there's any chance in the future the facts that I've cited to support that belief will change. He was at a press conference yesterday. And it's almost 13 minutes past the hour, but we should let you know about a developing storm, a tropical storm. We briefly mentioned it in the weather forecast earlier. There is a tropical storm expected to form along the Gulf Coast today, and forecasters are warning the name is Arthur, and the tropical storm Arthur could bring up to a foot of rain and dangerous flooding to parts of Louisiana and Texas as well. A tropical storm watch is now in effect along the coast, where forecasters say the potential typical or tropical cyclone is currently about 250 miles southwest of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Flood warnings have also been issued near Lake Charles and in parts of Texas. Officials are urging residents in Galveston to prepare for heavy rain, wind gusts, and possible flooding. And the most severe weather expected between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. local time, so about 2 hours from now. So take a note of it if you're in that area. It is a Wednesday morning. It's June 17th, and June is Internet Safety Awareness Month. We'll discuss up next. It's a Wednesday morning. It's June 17th. Great to be with you here on EWTN's Catholic Connection Monday through Friday. We are working on getting a hold of our scheduled guest. Of course, Donna Rice Hughes is with Enough is Enough. It's a wonderful organization that works with families and the government to really provide safety for families and learning how to use the internet and all media, especially social media, wisely. We are working on getting in touch with her. We might do a switcheroo, so we'll see if she joins us. We can put her on in the second hour. But I thought I would use this time, since we have it, to discuss what I was going to bring up, and may still, depending on where we go with Donna, if she does come around, could be a phone issue. Hey, it's live radio. Things happen. You always have to be prepared, like the Boy Scouts. Anyhow, this story is so compelling regarding this young woman who wrote this open letter to this, I'm using the air quotes here, doctor who performed a mastectomy on her several years ago. There's a story on Fox News. It's on their homepage, and so I did a little digging, and I found the letter, but I just wanted to share with you a little bit of background here. And this really does tie in with June being Internet Awareness Safety Month, because where do most of these young people get these ideas that or are pressured or brainwashed into thinking that the only way they're going to solve whatever issue they may be having is to go through, in many cases, irreversible, extremely dangerous surgery, so-called surgery. They call it transitioning surgery. And there's more and more young people speaking out, including this young woman, and her name is Claire Abernathy. A detransitioner who underwent a double mastectomy as a teen is publicly confronting the surgeon who performed the procedure, accusing him in an open letter of removing her healthy breasts without adequately addressing the underlying causes of her distress. Now, she posted this letter last week, about a week ago, last Thursday. Her letter to plastic surgeon Dr. Alan Dullen details her regret over the surgery and describes the physical and emotional toll she continues to experience years later. She says, "You took advantage of a little girl's confusion and a family's trust to perform an unnecessary disfiguring surgery on a child who was barely through puberty. You committed an act of violence that I have to wear on my skin for the rest of my life." And in a recent opinion piece for Fox News, Abernathy wrote she was put on testosterone at 14 years old, and then 8 months later, surgeons performed a double mastectomy on her. "I am no longer that silent, vulnerable 14-year-old. I'm a woman living in the wreckage of your carelessness." Dullen is described on the website for the American Institute for Plastic Surgery as a board-certified plastic surgeon, quote, serving patients throughout the Dallas and Fort Worth area, including Plano, Frisco, and Dallas. The site says he focuses on cosmetic plastic surgery and approaches aesthetic surgery as a collaborative process rooted in education, transparency, and individualized planning. His goal is to help patients make informed decisions that support confidence and long-term satisfaction. Oh, really? Well, listen to this. An October report from the Texas Insider said that Abernathy's double mastectomy at the American Institute for Plastic Surgery in Plano, Texas, was done on her between her 8th and 9th grade, and the surgery, guess how long the consultation was? 15 minutes. See, this is the thing, and I'm going to dive into this more deeply on Friday, in Fact Check Friday, because the media have a lot to do with this in terms of the lack of responsibility in digging into this, and they're going along with the language of gender-affirming care. And you put that out there, right? And that becomes the mantra. Everybody is like a parrot, and they repeat it. And then it gets into our culture, into our heads, into our institutions, and you have these horrible things happening to children. And many of them now are going through these detransitioning periods, but it's never going to be totally successful in terms of the damage that's done to their body. And this is coming out, thanks be to God. There was a major lawsuit that was won by a young woman who sued for similar reasons. And then we had those workers in Great Britain who were working at a so-called transitioning clinic. They thought they were helping young people. And then they realized that there was very little consultation taking place before these kids were put on puberty blockers and then even being performed on in terms of surgeries. So let me just share a little bit more of this letter that she wrote and that she posted online. So again, this is Claire Abernathy, and this was on the anniversary of her mastectomy. "Before I begin, let it be clear that I will not honor you with the title of doctor. A doctor is a healer, a protector of life and health who adheres to the sacred oath of doing no harm. You are a sick man who used a medical degree as permission to disfigure children, and I refuse to grant you a title that you have so thoroughly disgraced. Until you were stopped by the passage of Texas Senate Bill 14 in 2023, you were prolific in the field of ideologically driven child mutilation. You, a single man, We're third on the list of institutions who bill the most to private insurance companies for pediatric transgender surgeries. Between 2016 and 2022, competing with major institutions such as the Boston Children's Hospital and New York University Medical Center, you turned the destruction of children's healthy bodies into a high-volume business. I have lived every day for the last 7 years of the physical and psychological wreckage you left behind. When I was 14 years old, you took a scalpel to my healthy body and amputated my breasts. I didn't have the capacity to understand the permanence of what you were doing to me. I didn't have the foresight to know what it would feel like to reach adulthood and realize that my future and my bodily integrity had been stripped away before me, even before I reached high school. But you did. You were an adult. You were the expert. You were the one who held the oath to do no harm. What is most sickening, she says, what keeps me awake with a rage I can barely contain is the fact that you are a father. You have daughters of your own. When you look at them, she asks, do you see flesh to be cut or a human being to be protected? Did your wife nurse those children? Do you watch that bond, that fundamental experience, and then decide it was a responsible choice to steal the future from a 14-year-old girl? How do you look at your own children and then walk into an operating room to perform such a violent, irreversible procedure on someone else's little girl? Now, there are some very gruesome details in terms of her surgery, so I won't go into that. But all I have to say is this young girl has a lot of courage. I do hope that she's able to deal with her rage and somehow find forgiveness to give her more peace. But thanks be to God, she is speaking out. More people need to speak out, and more people need to be aware of what's going on. This is nonsense, this is evil, and it must stop. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour now. It's a Wednesday, and it's time for Shrines and Wonders Wednesday, based on my two volumes now of Italy's Shrines and Wonders. First coming out last year, the second just released yesterday from EWTM Publishing. I'm so excited. And if you're the Kindle type of person, I do believe there's a sale going on. You can get it on Kindle on Amazon, so just check that out if you're interested. But otherwise, we do hope that you will visit the EWTM Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com. And also, if you're interested to go along with the book, which works very nicely, if you recall, earlier this year, right after Easter, the EWTN Learn series through our wonderful mission advancement team was released, and it too is all about St. Francis. It's 8 parts, and it's free. You can just download it for free. There's no problem. You don't have to buy anything. But if you'd like to make a donation, a small donation, you will get a copy of this book. So it's up to you. You can just buy the book, or you can go online at EWTN.com/St. Francis, and the book will be available for you along with the series. This book, I think, is really special. This is the year of St. Francis, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to write it. But it will serve if you enjoy going to Assisi or are looking forward to going to Assisi, even if you can't get there this year for the year of St. Francis, of course, marking 800 years of his passing. This is a great tool for you. It's also a great tool in addition to understanding the details about Assisi. It's also a good tool for seeing other places associated in the life of St. Francis, towns that really helped form him, towns that were very significant in terms of his ministry. It's not just about Assisi. Obviously, that's where he was born, that's where he passed away, that's where he's buried, that's where you can go venerate his tomb, St. Clair the same, other saints as well. Now the amazing St. Carlo Acutis is buried there in the middle of Assisi, at St. Mary Major Church. But this is an opportunity to learn about places such as Spoleto, which is actually where his conversion began. Or maybe you want to learn more about Collestrata. There was a battle between Assisi and Perugia taking place there. It's a beautiful, tiny, tiny town on the top of a mountain, now overlooking a big mall, the Collestrata Mall, which is a big shopping mall in our area. But it's so historic. Or maybe you want to go on the Path of the Birds, a place where St. Francis was known to meet the animals and sing to the birds. The birds, you know, he spoke to the birds, the birds sang back. There's a whole path. There's three places the Path of the Birds, there's a shrine, and then there's also a church dedicated to the saint in the beautiful Umbrian town of Bavagna, where they have a special relic, a stone on which St. Francis rested while he was preaching to the animals in that part of Italy. So we really tried to provide you with some wonderful, unique places in this book, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Obviously, we do give you a great deal of details on Assisi because that's where it all began and where his ministry, well, where he died, not where the ministry ended. I would say it even took off further after he died, obviously. But the other place we go to, for example, is Greccio. Greccio is in Lazio, in northern Lazio, which is south of Umbria, where he created the first creche. We also take you to Liverna in Tuscany, where he received the stigmata. And what we tried to do with this book is give you a truly realistic look at the life of this spiritual giant. Too many of us, myself included, and I talk about that in the introduction, put him in a box and think of him about this wonderful, peaceful saint, which he was, who would walk around and the birds would be tweeting around his head and the butterflies would be flying and there was nothing to upset anyone. It was all, you know, smiles and big hearts and all kinds of stuff. Well, that's not totally true. Yes, Francis was joyful. Yes, he had a connection with creation. Definitely, it was a big part of his ministry. But he struggled and he pushed through and he worked so hard to the point of sickness and exhaustion. And if you think that he didn't have any issues within the church or within his own orders, well, you're wrong. Because he went to Liverna, actually, in Tuscany to pray toward the end of his life and to seek solace because there was so much infighting with the Franciscans. And so I think he's very relatable in that way. And also, I think right now, this week in particular, he is a great saint toward whom we can look regarding peace. His hometown, Assisi, is known as the City of Peace, the Città del Pace, and he is known as the Saint of Peace. One of the reasons is that in all of his travels, he didn't just travel all over Italy, he made it all the way over to Egypt and the Holy Land. And when he was in Egypt, he was going to preach to the Christian soldiers in the middle of the Crusades, the Fifth Crusade more specifically, and he met with the Muslim Sultan there, a devout Muslim. And it wasn't about conversion per se, it was about bringing peace. But he did meet with him, they had a constructive meeting, to the point where the Sultan wanted to give him all these different gifts. He only accepted one, and that one was a beautiful ivory horn that was used in prayer that is housed in a big reliquary in the sanctuary of the Basilica of St. Francis. So there's so much more in this book than what people may be aware of. I know I wasn't aware of a lot of it. I've learned it gradually going to Assisi over so many years and leading so many pilgrimages. And living here in the land of St. Francis has made a huge difference on my perspective as well as my husband's, Deacon Dom. About 2 minutes left. So something super fun that happens in many places in Italy. And I don't know if you've ever seen this when you've been here, if you've seen any type of the festivals that they do in the summer and the fall, which are so colorful and so local, so regional. Well, in our area in central Italy, they have something called the Palio del Batti. Batti means barrel, and it basically is the rolling of these giant wine barrels up and down the streets. I'm not kidding you. Some of them can weigh as much as 200 pounds, even more. And they have teams. For example, in our area, they're having a whole week-long festival. It started Sunday. It's ending this Sunday with a big race, I think, on Saturday night, and then a big celebration on Sunday. But it's very, very important to the local people, to the point where all the rioni, or the regions or neighborhoods of the town, have different flags and different colors representing their region. And when you go into town, the night of the big competition, where they have men and women dressed in these really cool medieval costumes, and they're getting ready to roll these huge barrels up and down the streets, these flags are everywhere. The people are having their flags, maybe wearing their flags, and just cheering, and it's just very festive. Families are out. This happens probably till 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and even after that, there's more celebrating. But it's very friendly. It's very tame. It doesn't get, you know, wild or anything like that, and it's so traditional. And in our area, in addition to the actual contest, to get the palio, which is like the banner or the flag that they receive if they win, that you've probably heard of palio because of Siena. That's probably the most famous palio with the horse races. But in our area, it is just so neat to see because these regions, it's such a tiny town, for example, this town of Marciano, which is not too far from where we live, has maybe 20,000 people. And yet you've got all these different groups that come. And in the middle of the celebration, as they're preparing for the big contest, they have this medieval dinner, and you can buy a ticket, and you sit there for hours and watch different types of competitions of men, whether they're doing actually a sword battle or archery competition, and they have judges. But again, everyone is dressed in period costumes from the Renaissance, and they have judges that are at the high table, and they are basically the royal family of the area. They're supposed to represent royalty. And you get served quite the wonderful Renaissance dinner with wine and different foods that, you know, come from, you know, previous recipes from centuries ago. It's just one big, wonderful festival with lots of color, lots of character, and so very Italian. It's called the Palio del Botti. Basically means the rolling of the barrels, or the banner of the barrels, I should say, more specifically for Palio. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Great to catch up with Joan Lewis for Joan's Rome. Okay, girlfriend, how hot is it in Rome? It's about 90 here in Umbria already, and it's 339. How hot is it in Rome?
Well, to be honest, I've been in most of the day, so, and I haven't even checked, but it was supposed to reach mid to high 90s by today and tomorrow, so yes, hot.
Wow. So think about the people at the audience today. Mamma mia.
Oh,
that would have been,
I just wondered, you know, we didn't see any incidences of, you know, the coming around to help anybody who fainted, but I think they had to have been distressed for, I mean, I can join the Holy Father, but on the other hand, you know, just wanting to drink and be in the shade. Some people put up umbrellas, but the problem with that, obviously, is how you can block the people behind you, you know,
right,
from seeing the Pope. So anyway, it just had to be unbelievably hot in the square, because it's hot even when it's just in the low 80s, so
right,
much less than 90s. But it was, you know, a wonderful, beautiful audience, and the popes almost always, when they've come back from a trip the following Wednesday at the general
right
audience, they talk about that trip, reviewing each of the stages of a trip, saying what it meant and everything else. And so the Pope said, told the faithful, I want to share some reflections with you. And he spoke of how he was comforted by the joyful expression of faith and affection shown by the people of God, as well as the crowds that welcomed me with such warmth. I mean, we all saw the staggering numbers at every single event. And he said he sensed not only the deep-rooted faith of the Spanish people, but a desire for unity and hope that can only be found in Christ and his love for us. And he said the experience reminded him, he had spoken at the opening of his remarks about his previous trips several countries in Africa, and then he was, this time of course it was Europe, and he said the cultural wealth of Europe, the strong cultural heritage, and the role it can play currently in promoting peace, respect for human dignity, and fraternal dialogue. Then the Pope ended his comments by issuing an invitation to the faithful. And he said, my motto for this trip was lift up your gaze. And I invite you, I extend that invitation, lift your gaze up to the Lord. Let us learn from him to see other people and the world around us as he does. So, and he thanked everyone for the success of the apostolic journey. And by the way, speaking of the journey, we all know his return to Rome took place on the Royal Falcon jet.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Because Friday, it was absolutely amazing. I was trying to watch the farewell ceremony online on the Vatican News page. And at a certain point, the plane, everybody's on, the doors are closed, the stairs are away. And there were two technical guys who just like never left the plane. They were standing under the nose of the plane, another nearby. And I think I now know why the guy was hardly moving from the nose of the plane, because he just kept waiting and waiting and nothing was happening, et cetera. And what we now know, of course, the Pope had to get off the plane. There was a technical problem that could not be quickly solved, so the king offered to give him his own Falcon jet. And the interesting thing is, what I discovered is that I had no idea King Felipe of Spain was a pilot, but he was standing there with a whole bunch of other people waiting to see the Pope off, and he was just standing there. He said to one of the people next to him, he said, he said, something's wrong, and I can tell you right now what it is. One of the two motors is not turning on. And it turned out that motor number one indeed was not turning on, but he recognized it right away as a pilot. And so, the word...
He should have got in and flew his own plane, the Pope home.
Yeah,
that would have been
probably
fun.
he probably could have flown to... I don't think the country of Spain would have allowed that, you know, to have their... have something
that would be that would have been pretty... That would have made a great story, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would have been one of the best stories of the entire year. But anyway, I mean, common sense prevailed in the sense of, you know, the king offering his jet to the Pope and a small group of people. But I had no idea he was a pilot. And but there are a lot of world leaders who have, you know, done military service earlier in their life, and some we know about and some we don't. And but then you find out that so-and-so is a, I think Prince Harry is a pilot, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure about about William. So when you set your mind to it.
No, isn't Prince Andrew? But Prince Andrew is a pilot, too. Even though he's no longer...
In the royal family, they all had that. Mm-hmm. They had the service and everything else. So I just thought that was an interesting aspect that the king said either it was motor one or it was one of the motors, and it turned out to be engine one. You know, so anyway that trip worked out well. The Holy Father made no specific remark of that I heard today about that, but. In any event, a wonderful trip. And but what he got back on Friday, he only had one audience on Saturday morning, which of course was very wise as they were planning this papal trip to give him, you know, a day off, basically. And then Sunday, of course, was the Angelus, at which he spoke with great warmth and love about his trip to Spain, and again thanking very profusely the King Felipe the sixth of Spain. And then, you know, now he's back in the groove of different meetings, different groups. Today, the Wednesday audience, and he met two groups before that. But he did, thank the Lord, go to Castel Gandolfo Monday afternoon for his usual Monday night and Tuesday day off at in the papal properties. And but he had a because the only thing that upset everybody about the Pope coming back on a separate plane was that there would be no, because all the journalists look forward to having the press conference.
The impromptu press conference on board,
And when you think about it, how tired the Pope, you know, must have been. They all had to be, not tired, just exhausted. But you kind of perk up just a bit when you know the Pope's coming in and you might ask him a question. So, they didn't get to do that on the plane, but they did spend about 7 or 8 minutes last night with the Pope as he came out of the papal property before he was driven back to Rome. Some of the questions that they had wanted to ask on the plane, they did, and there wasn't time for follow up. But one of the he talked about the Iran agreement, you know, and he said that today at the audience too. How delighted he was to know about the agreement between the U.S. and Iran, and he said, thank God there's at least a memorandum that they will officially sign on Friday. And the Pope said there will be several points to be established, but it's always better to do so through negotiation rather than returning to war. And then Leo said he hoped that the memorandum might, quote, truly be a solution to the war, that the war really is over, and that we can move forward for the good of all, and we must eliminate nuclear weapons, yes, and seek the good of all people, et cetera. So, you know, we too have to hope the same thing. And again, he told the journalist that last night, and he said basically the same words at the audience today. So, but I think one of the important things about his remarks last night were there, if any of our listeners, you know, have been paying any attention, we've briefly mentioned it, and many news, Catholic news sources have referred to the SSPX, which is the Society of St. Pius X, and they had announced quite a number of months ago that they planned on ordaining four men as bishops, and they would go ahead and do so, apparently scheduled for July 1st. They would do so without the papal mandate, because no man in the Catholic Church can be made a bishop without the reigning pope's permission. And so just to let people know, the SSPX, it's a traditionalist Catholic priestly society. It was founded in 1970, and it emphasizes pre-Vatican II liturgy and has a canonically irregular status within the Catholic Church. So when the Pope was talking about the, divisions, if you will, in the Church, he said, referring to the SSPX, he said, the Pope was asked if they were going to go ahead with the consecrations, and he said, we are still considering, he spoke of the communication between the society and, of course, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, because anything that has to do with church doctrine would be there, and we got a lot of doctrine from Vatican Council, too. So many things did change in the church after that, but Pope Leo said, quote, we are still considering making another appeal to say, do not do this. Let us try to live in communion in the church. But it's their choice. We must realize what it means for them and the church. He said, certainly division among Christians is always a painful point, but they, the SSPX, refuse to accept certain fundamental elements of the church, starting with various points of the Second Vatican Council. And Leo ended with, if they make that choice, I am sorry, but we must move forward. Wow. And not that he specified it there, but what in moving forward, in other words, the SSPX, if they go ahead with those four episcopal ordinations without the papal mandate, they have created technically, according to canon law, a schism. And that means that it is one of the cases that provides for excommunication. So that's very, very sad. And at this point, what we don't know, I think we mentioned this in a previous show, is, you know, is it the people who do the ordaining and the so-called newly ordained bishops or consecrated bishops, or what about the faithful that go to all the traditional Latin masses that this body has? So, because it wouldn't be the faithful who chose not to obey the Pope. It would be the leaders of the SSPX. So, potentially sad days ahead for a number of faithful, and even we should be sad that this...
Well, yeah, because, and the Pope makes a great point, because division in the church, and how many of us know that we've had friends that say, oh, well, you know, you guys, look at you guys, you can't even get along with each other, how are we, you know? And it does, I mean, we all understand, and this goes back centuries, I mean, Jesus had division, I mean, look at Judas, and look what happened, and you read the New Testament, especially in the Acts of the Apostles, and there were many disagreements and discussions. But at the same time, this will get an awful lot of attention, and it will. It's heartbreaking, because there's a tear there.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you have a law, and it's kind of like, what don't you understand about the red light, you know, in traffic? And
right.
Of course, you can go through it, but you could also very possibly pay a huge price and cause someone else to be involved in an accident, et cetera. So there are red lights and laws and regulations in every type of government, and that includes the Catholic Church. We have canon law. And when laws are written down, it's done with great care and concern,
right,
Teresa. You and I know this.
Right.
You know, for the souls of the faithful. They want to protect us. They want to help us. You know, you've got to stay within these lines.
Stay in the boat, right?
Yeah.
Don't leave the mothership.
Stay in the bark of Peter, exactly, you know. But the lines are drawn. You have Gola, hey, we've got the, you know, Mondiale, the World Cup being played out in America. and just look at the field. There's all kind of lines everywhere that are drawn.
Right, and they have to. And we're out of time, but that is a great analogy. And look forward to seeing you next week when we get in on Tuesday. I'm speaking at the EWTN Academy, but we get to see each other on Tuesday. We'll be right back on a Wednesday morning edition of Catholic Connection. Stay tuned. Thanks so much for tuning in to the first hour of Catholic Connection here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio on this June 17th, 2026. Well, we did finally reach Donna Rice Hughes, so she's going to be joining us in the next hour. I know she was supposed to be on with us in the first hour, but we've got some very important topics to discuss, including June being Internet Safety Month, the UK social media ban, and more. So she'll be with us for, let's see, one segment she'll be with us. And then we're also going to be talking with Father Ignatius Schweitzer and Father Jesse Maingo. The topic will be Eucharistic Adoration. I'm really excited about this because there's so much discussion about Eucharistic Adoration. I don't know if you've noticed this. One of the good things about the media, there's an awful lot of beautiful clips, especially since Corpus Christi Sunday, about Eucharistic processions going on, not only all over the world, but across the country. And there's a lot of great young people who are on different outlets, such as TikTok and whatnot, explaining the Blessed Sacrament, what it is, what happens during Eucharistic Adoration. And it's so beautiful the way they're doing that. So should be a really good hour of important topics. And we always try to keep you connected, hence the name of the program. Let's see. So Donna Rice will be with us right after the news and the weather. We'll talk 15 minutes about things that are happening in media. And I think I wanted to mention, too, she also has some great ideas and a new product available or some sort of a tool. I'm not sure. We'll find out more about working with parents and the media, social media more particularly. Talk to you on EWTN Extra. Please stand by, as we say in broadcasting, or sit down if you're more comfortable. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
Hour number two of Catholic Connection here on EWTN's Radio Extra, June 17th. Thanks for tuning in. And since Donna Marie Cooper Boyle is a good friend of mine. He's a great writer and speaker on EWTN. Anyway, I meant to say Donna Rice Hughes. That means I have to call Donna. I haven't talked to her in a while. Donna Rice Hughes with Enough is Enough is going to be joining us at 16 minutes past the hour after the weather and the news this morning. She was set to join us in the first hour, but there were some technical difficulties, but we have her now. So this will be great because it's very, very timely with June being Internet Safety Month, with a recent ban just announced by the UK on social media for teens under 16. A lot of stuff to talk about and very important with Donna Rice Hughes. And then we're going to have two segments, actually, on Eucharistic Adoration. We have two wonderful priests who are in studio with us this morning. They're at the headquarters of EWTN in Irondale for some interviews. Father Ignatius Schweitzer and Father Jesse Maingo are going to be talking to us about getting closer to the Lord through adoration, and they're both experts, and we'll tell you why when they join us at the bottom of the hour. Okay, need to tell you about the weather. The National Weather Service is still talking about excessive rainfall and potential tropical cyclone in the south, and we still have a threat for severe thunderstorms coming up in the Midwest. National Weather Service saying excessive rainfall could produce locally considerable flash flooding. This will happen over parts of the northwestern Gulf Coast, the lower Mississippi River Valley, and the deep south, and that's through tomorrow. Then we have the chance of that potential tropical cyclone. It's forecast to become Tropical Storm Arthur as it moves along or just off the northwestern Gulf Coast through today. And then we have an outbreak of severe weather forecast for the Midwest, and that's also for later today. So there's your forecast on a Wednesday morning, June 17th. Thank you so much for tuning in at 2 minutes past the hour. It is time for the news here on EWTN's Radio Extra.
Federal law enforcement officials say multiple people have now been taken into custody after discussing plans to attack the UFC event at the White House over the weekend. One of those arrested is from Ohio, where Governor Mike DeWine says a news should serve as a reminder to stay vigilant.
Look, we live in difficult times, and there are people out there who are inclined and capable of doing very bad things.
According to a criminal complaint, 19-year-old Tyson Proper was arrested in Knox County and faces four criminal counts, including attempted murder of an officer or employee of the U.S. The plot is believed to have involved using drones and a gunman to cause harm at the event on Sunday, the FBI and Secret Service reportedly uncovering the plans and messages between the suspects. Meanwhile, the FBI says a worried mom's tip was a key factor in stopping that alleged plot to attack the Freedom event over the weekend. According to court documents, a mother of the 19-year-old Ohio suspect became alarmed after noticing several things, including his online communications with strangers, his spending about $3,000 of his graduation money on ballistic armor plates, a shotgun, and large quantities of ammunition, and researching locations near the nation's capital, as well as receiving maps and images online. She contacted police on June 10th, 4 days before the event, after confronting him about his behavior. And Daniel Martindale is in California, meanwhile, and he has more on the two suspects from that state connected to the alleged terror plot.
Brian Omar Roa and Michael Allen Thomas from Riverside County are facing federal conspiracy to commit murder charges. Both men made their initial court appearances on Monday in Riverside. The FBI says they are planning to use explosive-laden drones and snipers to assassinate political leaders at UFC Freedom 250. Authorities confirm a multi-agency law enforcement operation successfully neutralized the threat of a large-scale attack. A federal criminal complaint says Roa and Thomas were reported to the FBI by a 19-year-old co-conspirator from Ohio. I'm Daniel Martindale.
In other news this morning, the president is suggesting the deal between the U.S. and Iran can survive even if Israel continues its attacks in Lebanon. The president sharing the comments while speaking from the G7 in France, but he rejected the loss of innocent lives. When asked if the Iran deal can survive, the president said it can, but noted that Israel is fighting Hezbollah too long and too many people are being killed. His comments come as tensions with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rises due to the attacks in Lebanon, but Netanyahu has insisted on targeting Iran-backed Hezbollah. The president says Netanyahu has to be more responsible with respect to Lebanon. And Mark Mayfield fills us in on Democrats and even some Republicans who are expressing skepticism about the U.S.-Iran framework agreement set to be signed on Friday.
Most of the concern from Republicans surrounds reports that claim the U.S. will send funds to Iran, but Vice President J.D. Vance says that's not true.
Not a single cent of American money under any circumstance, no matter what the Iranians do, goes to Iran.
Vance says the agreement does allow Iran to reach peaceful benchmarks, which would then allow other countries in the region to invest in Iranian infrastructure. Vance adds the agreement does state Iran must never develop or buy a nuclear weapon. His boss, President Trump, insists that it's a good deal that will open the Strait of Hormuz and stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon as further negotiations are scheduled after the signing. I'm Mark Mayfield.
President Trump announcing on social media over the weekend that the peace deal with Iran has been reached. But again, lawmakers in Congress say they haven't been briefed. U.S. Senator of Iowa and chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, also says lawmakers still are not aware of the terms.
It would be better, from my point of view, if we had had it in our hands yesterday. And I don't see a reason why we haven't had. We have not been briefed on it. We haven't been told that we're going to have a briefing.
Other senators releasing a statement saying a deal of this magnitude deserves thorough review. It's critical the Senate has the opportunity to examine the details. Asked about the recent agreement between the U.S. and Iran, the Holy Father said, thank God, there is at least this memorandum that they will officially sign on Friday. There are still several points, though, to be established, the Pope added, but it's always better to do so through dialogue and negotiation rather than war. The Holy Father expressing his hope that the memorandum of agreement might be truly a solution to the war, that the war is really over, and he added that we can also move forward for the good of all. He said, eliminate nuclear weapons, yes, seek the good of all peoples, seek to solve problems also at the economic and social levels that have been created in this time. Linda Bordoni reports from Vatican News that a joint declaration signed in Geneva is calling for an end to the use of artificial intelligence in military targeting operations.
The statement, endorsed by 226 organizations and experts, including the World Council of Churches, urges technology companies and governments to stop supplying AI systems used in the military kill chain and to ensure that AI technologies do not contribute to violations of international humanitarian law or human rights. The declaration was presented during a UN meeting on artificial intelligence in the military domain held in Geneva this week. It comes in the wake of Pope Leo XIV's encyclical Magnifica Humanitas and his appeal for the world to disarm AI. The signatories warn that AI is increasingly being used to accelerate warfare, enabling military operations to be carried out more quickly and on a larger scale. They argue that such systems risk undermining human responsibility in life and death decisions and could make it more difficult to identify accountability when violations of international law occur. Particular concern is expressed over the use of large language models and other AI tools to generate and prioritize military targets. According to the declaration, these technologies may weaken compliance with the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution that lie at the heart of international humanitarian law.
Republican Governor Mike DeWine, who has repeatedly postponed executions over the past 7 years, saying yesterday that Ohio should abolish the death penalty, confirming his change of heart on the policy he helped write as a state lawmaker some 45 years ago. The 79-year-old said during a news conference that more data indicates the death penalty is not serving as a deterrent to violent crime, which he had always believed was its moral imperative. I do not believe that argument today can be successfully made, he said, so nor do I believe that there's any chance in the future the facts that I've cited to support the belief will change. To explain his position, the Catholic Republican sharing charts and graphs detailing the diminishing number of death sentences meted out by courts and showing the exceedingly long wait times that elapse as legal appeals play out for those on death row. He said condemned murderers are increasingly unlikely to ever be executed, sometimes dying by natural causes or suicide before their execution date even arrives. And the results are being tallied for Georgia, Alabama, Oklahoma, and Washington, D.C., that following another day yesterday of primary elections. President Trump's political clout was again on the ballot, including in Georgia's Senate race, where he gave a last-minute endorsement to projected winner GOP Congressman Mike Collins over former football coach Derek Dooley in their primary runoff. In Alabama's Republican Senate primary runoff, Trump-backed Congressman Barry Moore is projected to defeat former Navy SEAL Jared Hudson. Rick Johnson is projected to win the Republican primary runoff for Georgia governor over Trump-endorsed candidate Burt Jones. Tammy Trujillo tells us federal prosecutors are accusing 15 people in Minnesota of conspiring to interfere with law officers during an immigration crackdown.
The alleged assailants were charged on Tuesday with conspiracy to impede or injure ICE officers during this year's raids in Minneapolis. Prosecutors allege the 15 were part of two so-called Minneapolis Antifa groups. 12 of the alleged assailants were arrested on Tuesday. One was already in custody and two remain at large. Dozens gathered outside the courthouse to speak out against the charges, with some calling them an act of political retribution to quell dissent. I'm Tammy Trujillo.
We mentioned this in the weather, but here's a little bit more on that tropical storm. It's expected to form along the Gulf Coast today. Forecasters are warning that Tropical Storm Arthur could bring up to a foot of rain and dangerous flooding to parts of Louisiana and Texas. A tropical storm watch is in effect along the coast, where forecasters say the potential tropical cyclone is currently about 250 miles southwest of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Flood warnings have been issued near Lake Charles and in parts of Texas. Officials are urging residents in Galveston to prepare for heavy rain, wind gusts, and possible flooding. The most severe weather is expected between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. local time. And work continues on a new flood warning system in the Texas Hill Country nearly 1 year after a deadly flood.
We are estimating somewhere between 20 and 30 sirens is the total need along the river.
That's Kerr County disaster consultant William Whitson, who says that's part of a larger system of water gauges along the Guadalupe. One of the biggest questions going forward, developing protocols for what conditions will trigger an alert and who has the authority to activate warning sirens. Brad Ford tells us Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has declared a wildfire state of emergency.
Governor Tina Kotek says increasing heat, dry conditions, and shifting winds can cause wildfires to grow. The declaration gives the Oregon Department of Forestry and State Fire Marshal access to resources they need to coordinate a response to fires. Oregon Emergency Management will activate the state's Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan, and the Oregon National Guard can be activated as necessary to help fight wildfires. I'm Brad Ford.
And Meta is rolling out new artificial intelligence features aimed at changing how users search for information on Facebook and Instagram as well. The company says the updates are part of a broader effort to integrate AI into everyday experiences across its platforms. A new feature called AI Mode is designed to provide answers and search results informed by conversations and public discussions that are shared on Facebook. Meta is also introducing AI-powered tools designed to help users create and edit photos and videos. Meta says its Muse Spark technology helps surface insights, opinions, and perspectives from users. The new tools are being introduced as competition intensifies in the AI search space. And speaking of technology and the internet and all that, we'll have a deep discussion with Donna Rice Hughes from Enough is Enough coming up. We'll be right back. Appreciate the great work of Donna Rice Hughes. She's president and CEO of Enough is Enough. Boy, we have a lot to discuss today, especially in this month of June. So much going on. June is Internet Safety Month. Also, there were some recent decisions, a big one in Florida regarding TikTok, a big one in the UK regarding another ban, another country banning social media for teens under 16. And then we don't want to end this interview without mentioning the wonderful tools that Donna has for families along so many areas in terms of internet safety and protection. Donna, let's start with the story out of Florida with the TikTok decision. Tell us about that and your thoughts.
Yes, well, it's a very positive move. Florida actually has a state law, which is absolutely terrific, and they require social media platforms to restrict access. It's not a ban, just to restrict access to kids under, I believe it's 14 years old in Florida. And even Meta complied with this law, all right? But the Attorney General filed a lawsuit just this week against TikTok because TikTok did not comply. So there are fines associated for non-compliance. So now, is my understanding, according to the news articles, that TikTok has now alerted kids under 14 that they no longer have access to TikTok. So this is a really, really good move for a lot of different reasons. Number one, it shows our Congress at the federal level that we can do this, that there is a will, there is a desire for parents to be able to have some help to help them manage their kids' time online, because kids are not supposed to be on any of these social media platforms if they're under 13 years old.
Right.
That's U.S. law, but these companies do not have age verification technologies, and they are not enforcing the law. So your 8-year-old daughter can go set up a TikTok or a Meta account or an Instagram or anything else. So that's just the way it's been since the advent of social media. But we do not have a federal law like that in place. But they are doing this for nations and other nations, Australia, UK, India, and the list goes on.
Yeah. So, yeah, speaking of the UK, United Kingdom just on Monday has a social media ban. It doesn't take place for a little while, but they announced this, and the Prime Minister was talking, basically sounded a lot like you in raising concerns about what this does to kids. Do you think the United States is eventually going to do something like this, ban social media for young people under 16? What do you think?
Well, let me just tell you, no, not right now. And here's okay. Why. There has been a wonderful piece of legislation co-sponsored by Senator Blackburn and Senator Blumenthal, bipartisan. One's a Republican, one's a Democrat. All these laws are bipartisan. Let me just say that about this, okay? It's called the Kids Online Safety Act. It does not go nearly as far as saying kids under a certain age cannot be on these platforms. and you have to age verify and ban and all this kind of stuff. It is basically requiring platforms to have a duty of care, you know, to have the parental controls and the defaults turned on to the strictest safety settings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's been introduced now for the third Congress, right now. Okay? It was passed last year, went to the House of Representatives, and the House did not pass it. They did not push it through. There was a lot of pushback. So it's back on the table again in the Senate. The House has got their own version. I call it K Street COSA because it looks like it's written by big tech, right? It actually probably does worse than anything at all. So that's where our Congress is. So to have them go as far as Florida has gone and other states have gone, in the UK, in Australia was the first nation to do this. I just don't see it happening since we can't even get COSA passed.
Yeah. I want to get your response to these great quotes from the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Starmer, who said, among other things, every parent can see it with their own eyes. Social media is making children unhappy. He has two teenage children of his own, and he told reporters, I've heard firsthand from families crying out for change, and we will do right by them. I mean, obviously, he's feeling it as well. I mean, it is so obvious in terms of what's going on. That's why we need this. So in terms of the follow-up, I know Australia was the first. That's been a while. It's been a couple of months that it's been in effect. Mm-hmm. How long do you think it will take before we see, like, the evidence, the good evidence from this, the good positive fallout in terms of the impact these measures have on families and teens, do you think, Donna?
I don't know. I mean, I believe that parents are going to see an immediate change.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because we already know the data shows that just limiting screen time and having detox just from screens, regardless of social media, online gaming, and everything else, it starts to have immediate effect, right? I mean, the kids may go through detox. I mean, they're going through detox. It's like getting them off a drug, right?
Right.
But once they detox from the screens or detox from the addictive algorithms of social media, I think parents are going to see immediate results. How that is measured on a national scale or whatever, who knows? Somebody's got to measure it first, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any type of, there may be, if there's any type of a pace where people can, in these different countries now that have these bans, have had them for a while, that can share their own testimonies of the positive results, because that would be really cool to hear different testimonies. Okay, we only have about 3 minutes left, and I want to give you the time to talk about the wonderful guides, the safety guides that you have available for parents in different areas in terms of media, social media.
Yes, thank you so much. Well, we realize that enough is enough, that parents are still the first line of defense. We do want government to do what they can, and we need these big tech companies to be regulated because they won't voluntarily do anything on their own. They've had two decades to show that they're not going to do this on their own, okay? So so we've got a lot of interactive guides. First, let me give you InternetSafety101.org. Just think InternetSafety101.org. This is a one-stop shop for you, parents and grandparents and teachers, of anything you need to know about the dangers to kids online and how to keep them safe. Now, we created these interactive guides, that we call them navigable guides. We've got one for social media, one for online gaming, one for smartphones, where we've listed the popular platforms, for instance, on social media, Snapchat, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, etc. And we go through all the features that they offer or don't offer. Then we link to tutorials for what they do offer for you to learn how to use those features. Because, again, like I was saying with the COSA Act, they're not turned on right now. So if you want to filter on, which is what we recommend, and you want time-limiting features, and you want to monitor and do a lot of the block apps, for instance, you've got to go do it yourself as a parent. So these guides show you how to do that on social media platforms and on online gaming platforms. Then we did a whole nother guide for smartphones for children and teens. That includes your Apple and your Android, of course, but it's also got these phones designed by these companies like Bark and Gab and Truemi that have designed their phones with child safety in mind. They have a lot better safety features, and they're just terrific. So again, we've got tutorials. You can compare, you know, when you're shopping. I mean, I think parents need to be shopping for what am I going to let my kids on or not. Then let me just say right now, if it's online gaming, social media, et cetera, they're not supposed to be on those platforms anyway until they're 13 years old. Yeah. And we do recommend limiting screen time. We also have a family contract that you can change for yourself. But if your kids are online, I don't care if they're 7 years old, even though I don't like them on at 7 years old, or right. Or 16, have that family contract. Know what they're doing on a regular basis and be that trusted person. Because if your kids are online every day, you need to be having those conversations every day to protect your kids.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Donna, this is so helpful because it's exhausting. And you're a grandparent. I'm a great aunt. And I know it's a challenge. It's a challenge for adults. It's easy for us to get addicted to whether it's, you know, scrolling or, you know, watching certain things, you know, online. So you make it so easy for parents because they need the help. But I am glad to see some of these other countries, at least, and states coming through for parents as well.
Oh, it's so important. I mean, our strategy since I began in 1994 has been you've got to have a shared responsibility. There is a holistic approach, right? Big tech needs to do their part. Government, law enforcement needs to do their part. And parents need to do their part. And it starts with parents.
You're the best. Donna Rice Hughes, Enough is Enough, President and CEO. We'll be right back. Enough.org is the website. Busy Wednesday morning, 28 minutes past the hour. Great to be with you and great to have our guests in studio with us back at the ranch in Irondale, Alabama, our beautiful EWTN headquarters. If you have not been there yet, it's really fun. Everybody is so nice. They roll out the red carpet for everyone who walks through the door. You can watch shows, including, of course, Father Mitch Live on Wednesdays. And tonight, our guests will be on that program, Father Ignatius Schweitzer and Father Jesse Mango, talking Eucharistic adoration. They've written a book about it. They're also speaking at the Shrine regarding Eucharistic adoration as well. Fathers, thank you so much for joining us this morning. So great to have both of you.
Thank you. So good to be with you.
Yeah, it's a great delight.
All right, so tell us, let me go to you first, Father Ignatius. Do you see, and I think this is happening, my husband and I have been talking about this, do you see a renewed understanding and an appreciation of the Eucharist, do you think?
I do. You know, I think the work of Eucharistic Revival for those 3 years has, you know, done a lot of work and more still needs to be done. But I do think people are more appreciative of the great gift that we have in the Eucharist, and people are adoring the Lord more. I think we need more, and we're trying to work on that and to keep the momentum going. But no, I think that there has been some key moves, and overall there's a greater appreciation of, yeah, just the love in the heart of our Lord Jesus as it shines forth in the Eucharist.
Father Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that throughout the centuries the Church has grown in its understanding of the gift of the Holy Eucharist, as you know, the gifts of the Holy Spirit operate more deeply in the soul. And I think we're living in a time of an outpouring of grace around the Holy Eucharist, and I suppose in divine providence the whole revival was brought up. And what I, from my own experience back in Trinidad and Tobago, where I'm from, and in our archdiocese, there's a greater hunger coming from the people, and even asking our own local bishop for more Eucharistic devotion. And also, just like the Eucharist is kind of coming alive, the Lord in the Eucharist come alive for many people in a very tangible, real way. And I see that in ministry as well.
Father Jesse, I spoke at a women's conference in Trinidad many years ago, and it was wonderful. And the Archbishop came in, and it was a very powerful experience. And the organizers are telling me, though, in Trinidad, they have one of the highest problems, largest problems with pornography. Is that changing? Is that getting better?
Yes, you know, that's very true. And our current Archbishop has great personal intentions to try and roll that back, you know. My own spiritual director, actually, to link it back to the theme of Eucharistic adoration, has always said that, you know, when we go to Eucharistic adoration, behold the Lord, we're beholding the pure one, the innocent flesh of Christ. And that is like an amazing remedy for people who've suffered from that addiction or problem, you know. And so that's something that I pose, especially to young men that I journey with, you know, draw them into the adoration chapel, and I see so many personal victories for them by as they come to the Lord, you know, and as they mm-hmm. behold the Pure One. It's kind of like a beautiful reordering of their minds.
Now, Father, you and Father Jesse wrote a book together, Father Ignatius. How did you come to work together? How did you get to know each other? How did that happen?
Yeah, we had a mutual friend who connected us and, you know, saw that we have a lot of similarities in our mind and heart, a deep draw to long hours of Eucharistic adoration, devotion to Our Lady Medjugorje, open to, you know, walking more deeply in the gifts of the Holy Spirit and such. And so he said, hey, you two need to get to know one another. And so mm-hmm. it started, you know, just through a couple WhatsApp chats over time because we were in different places. And then Father Jesse invited me to lead a pilgrimage to Medjugorje with him. And so then that was kind of our first week together in person. And from there, we've just been trying to get together as much as we can and lead retreats and do preaching together. And so, yeah, it's been a great friendship.
So, Father Jesse, how much are you able to see each other? And how are you able to, do you promote the book online together? I know you've been able to do a number of interviews here at EW10, but having co-authors being separated, that could be a little challenging.
Yes, we've just been blessed by divine providence that we've been able to come together, as Father said. Like, even Father Ignatius was recently in Trinidad as we were using our book throughout the whole Archdiocese of Port of Spain for a 33-day journey, of which the Archbishop then dedicated the Diocese of Corpus Christi this year to our Eucharistic Lord. So that was a great opportunity to be together, minister together, and we also held a conference for day on the Eucharist retreat, and that was just very powerful and to be affirmed again that the Lord is using our brotherhood to minister great Eucharistic graces. And but we also have a, throughout of being on that pilgrimage to Medjugorje, we started something called the Dominican House of Prayer with two lay Dominicans, Dr. Thomas Carr and Ina Carr. And we have a website called the DominicanHouseOfPrayer.com, and we also have a YouTube channel where we felt this call because of our both our love for the contemplative life and to mystical theology in the life of the Church to you know, just to have a platform whereby the laity can go and have videos about the saints, the mystics, you know, Catholic tradition on spirituality. And on that same website and our YouTube playlist, one could find videos, many videos of Father's projects, my projects, and also this book that we co-authored together, How to Be His, a 33-day dedication to our mm-hmm. Eucharistic Jesus. I made with a local television network, Catholic television network in Trinidad, I made a video for every day of the book. So people can find a playlist of, you know, of a video there to accompany their meditation on each day's theme in this Eucharistic book. So that's a great resource for the two of us.
Well, the book looks wonderful in terms of all the different writings. And Father Ignatius, you have some of my favorites in here, including St. Pierre Giorgio Frassati and St. Teresa, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. So this is very, very, and of course, St. Catherine of Siena, very deep material. How did you decide which saints and which writers about the Eucharist you were going to include? Father Ignatius, I'll go to you first.
You know, I think probably this is the same for both of us. Just, you know, the personal draw on our hearts through these particular saints and finding them to be great friends and guides in our Eucharistic devotion. And so, you know, I live in New York City, St. Joseph Seminary in Yonkers. So there are a lot mm-hmm. of downsides to living in New York City, but a benefit is there are a lot of missionaries of charity around. And yep. so I have a good relationship mm-hmm. with the four MC contemplative houses in the New York City area, preaching to them and giving them retreats and such. And so to feel kind of the spirit of Mother Teresa still alive in them and to learn from her teachings and Sister Nirmala, her first successor. And so, yeah, they've always been near and dear to my heart, and that's growing. And yeah, she lived an intensely Eucharistic life, a life vibrant rich with joy, a life deeply contemplative. And so I've learned a lot from Mother Teresa, and so wanted to share some of the wisdom from her, for instance, in this book.
And Father Jesse, in terms of your favorite writers, who do you mm-hmm. think, who's your favorite?
That's a good one. I mean, just in thinking of the days, same thing. You know, who am I drawn to? In you know, thinking of those, the 11 days with the saints, deeply drawn to Pope St. John Paul II and St. Charles de Foucault. So, you know, it's a hard one because they all, like, inspire. And that's why we wanted to have 11 Days with the Saints, because, You know, the lives of the saints are so contagious. They're anointed. You know, when we smell their holiness, you know, our hearts could catch on fire. When we hear their words of wisdom, you know, it's, you know, just seeing people using the book, like just see how the saints make such an impact on them, the witness of the saints, you know. But, you know, Pope St. John Paul would always say the Eucharist was the secret of his day, you know. And oh, yeah. I guess he's always inspired me. Many of his quotes, his words of wisdom, his witness. To see a pontiff, you know, reposing on the heart of the Eucharistic Lord is an immense, hopeful sign.
More on this beautiful book and the ministry of these two wonderful priests. The book is How to Be His, a 33-day dedication to our Eucharistic Jesus. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. It's a Wednesday, middle of the week, June 17th, having a great conversation with Father Jesse Mango and Father Ignatius Schweitzer. They've co-authored this beautiful book, How to Be His, a 33-day dedication to our Eucharistic Jesus. We were talking during the break, Fathers, that this is something that you get the best results, and I think this makes a lot of sense, if you follow through with the 33 days. And Father Ignatius, you want to pick up on that? Because some people say, well, I don't know if I can be consistent for 33 days. Maybe I can do one day or 2 days, and can I go back to it? What would you suggest to our listeners this morning with that?
Yeah, you know, if you miss a day here or there, just, you know, pick up where you left off. But it is nice, on the other hand, to aim at a solemnity or a special feast that you want to end the consecration on. And so in Trinidad, just, you know, this past Corpus Christi, Thursday, it was the culmination of the 33 days. And to have other people doing it together with you at the same time is amazing. When the book was first released, Avila Institute organized thousands of people.
Dan Burke.
Dan Burke.
Yeah, correct.
And to end on, and we led up to Christmas. And so the 33 days during Advent in terms of our Eucharistic Lord culminated on Christmas. And just doing it as a group as well with other people, even if it's just a small group of your friends, adds a certain potency, I think, to it. And you can talk about it as a group. And so, you know, that might be, you know, the best way to do it, you know, with other people. But then also, once you're through the 33 days, and this has been kind of constant feedback we've gotten, people are like, we have to, like, keep going through it. There's so much in these reflections.
Right.
And so to also see it as, you know, 33 meditations that you can use in the Eucharistic Adoration Chapel as you're drawn to this one or that one.
Yeah, I know. I hate to throw away my Magnificat. I mean, I have the app, but I love the hard copy. I love the artwork, and I love the reflections. I hate to throw them away or get rid of them because some of the reflections are so great. I want to go back to them. It's kind of the same thing. So, Father Jesse, let me go to you because I wanted to bring this one point about, well, there's many points, but I love that you say in this book, how to fall in love with our Eucharistic Lord and waste time with him. What does that mean?
That phrase actually came from a phrase that Pope Francis said, that, you know, he said that he was very concerned that the prayer of Eucharistic adoration was the least that people were engaging with in the general church. And he felt that, you know, that people needed to learn to waste time in a sense that, you know, when we go to adore the Lord and we're before the Lord, we could be many other places with many other people. But the fact that we're there, we're saying, Lord, you are first. You are worthy of all my time, you know, and we allow those other things to suffer away. And Pope Francis says, you know, well, he's the Lord and I adore him. Very simple. You know, that the Lord is in our midst. And we want people to have that consciousness that they, if they live around a church, you know, you live around the living, real presence of Jesus, you know. The tabernacle, the church is a big tabernacle in our neighborhoods, our parishes. So have that concept, to shift that consciousness and to realize, and even to move the language sometimes that we speak about the Eucharist. Even, you know, sometimes you'd have even priests or religious, so, you know, and they believe, you know, that this is the Lord, but they might refer to Eucharist as it, you know. It's like, well, it's not it, you know, it's him. You know, and just to even be so conscious of our language as Catholics when we speak about the Holy Eucharist to others, it can almost sound like it's it's like a container of the presence, and, you know, or so much so that a cousin of mine once said, you know, when you talk about the body of the Lord, is it just this like flesh? And I was like, no, it's him, you know, it's all of him. So to really drive home that the entire personality of Christ, all of him, present in the Holy Eucharist and through the Eucharist, you know, the sacrament. And so, yeah, I waste time just to I like the phrase, you know, some people don't, but I like the phrase because
I like it because as you know, you've both been to Italy. My husband and I live here part time. Italians are experts at, we look at it wasting time, but they are experts at slowing down. I mean, a lot of them have fallen away from their faith. We know that, but they are experts at slowing down and doing la dolce far niente, the sweetness of doing nothing. I would say do nothing with the Lord, just sit in his presence, right?
Amen.
Yeah, and when we do that, we are really engaging in eternal acts. Mm. You know, it's what we'll be doing, God willing, in heaven, you know, for all eternity. Mm-hmm. Spending time with the Lord, he goes to prepare a place for us that we might be with him, And so praising the Lord, adoring him, thanking him, savoring his presence. When you do that, you're engaging in what you'll be doing for all eternity. Mm-hmm. And so it can feel like a waste of time, but it's in fact the, you know, the best use of our time that you can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, relaxing with the Lord, right?
Absolutely.
Sitting there in prayer, just letting your fears and concerns go. As my mother used to say in her Jersey accent, offer it up to God and put it at the foot of the cross, which is one of the most important things she ever said to me, you know, as we were growing up. My sisters and I heard that all the time. And that's what you do, that you're just bringing it to Jesus, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're just being with him, right? As I say to people, you know, when a friendship gets so mature, you could be with a friend, you don't need to say a thing. In fact, the words might actually kind of interrupt the intimacy. You know, you're on a bench watching a beautiful sunset with your loved one, a family member, and you just, or like a mother who's just given birth to a child and is like trying, as St. Peter Julian Aymar says, like, would study the child, you know? Sorry, not St. Peter Julian, St. Manuel Garcia is actually a quote in the book. And how, you know, mother just in that adoration, trying to just soak in the mystery that this child is hers. Same thing with us in adoration. You know, this mystery that the Lord is ours, we are his, you know, and that he's present. You know, just soaking in that reality. It's very healing.
And I think when we do that,
go ahead, Father Ignatius.
And I think when we do that, we return to our greatest depths as well, to the depths of our heart, and then that transforms the rest of our day. Mm. And then we're not just living from a superficial level of ourself, or, you know, there's a place obviously for social media and things, but we often go too far with it. We feel scattered, left in a superficial place. And I feel like with the Eucharist and real presence, you know, that's what, you know, all the advantages of the internet and such, that is what it's lacking, real presence. And so it's a good anecdote to the excesses sometimes of AI or too much engagement in social media, where you have some, you know, flashy images, but not real presence. In the Eucharist, it's almost like the inverse, like it's God's solution. You don't have a flashy image, you have a simple host, the appearance of a simple host. But Christ's real presence filled with like such mystery, and to spend time with him, you enter more deeply into the depths of Jesus, the Eucharist, more into the depths of God, and you enter more into your depths. And now to live forth from that, where charity comes forth, and now all our little deeds can be suffused with God's own love.
Beautiful. The book is How to Be His, a 33-day dedication to our Eucharistic Jesus. It's co-authored by our two wonderful guests this morning who are in studio back in Irondale, Alabama, of course at EW10 Studios, Father Ignatius Schweitzer and Father Jesse Mango. All right, so Father Jesse, let me go back to you. How do we deal with being distracted? Because I know my patron, my favorite saint in the whole wide world, St. Teresa of Avila, would often say that she would get distracted and sometimes even bored and even count the bricks on the wall in the Adoration Chapel. Now, this is the first female doctor of the church who said this. So I don't think we should beat ourselves up too much if every once in a while we do have our minds drift. How do we deal with that, though, do you think?
I think that we can start becoming attentive of the distractions and even maybe turn the distractions into prayer. So sometimes we might think distractions, but maybe it's God even speaking to us. Maybe somebody's running across our mind or scenario or situation. You know, when I was a novice, we'd have community meditation in the morning, and those flights flying over sometimes could be distracting, the planes. And then I remember one of the older priests saying, well, just pray for the people on the plane, you know. And so, you know, it's like turning your distractions into prayer. But also, you know, the mind could be, depending what part of the day we're entering into prayer to as well, that the mind can be very busy, but the heart could still be engaged. And that's, you know, it's what St. Teresa of Avila herself says, what matters in prayer is not to think so much, but to love much. And, you know, I mean, it's so we could be distracted, but I think we could still sit there and try to make acts of love, love him, right? Amidst it. And just coming back to the Lord again and again means we're choosing him again and again. That glorifies him. He loves that, you know? So it's like the prodigal son coming home again and again. But I would tell people, you know, don't panic unless you're willfully distracting yourself and being negligent. That's another issue. But we, you know, that's our frailty, our human frailty. But it can be used towards the food, towards intimacy with him.
Yeah. And Father Ignatius, I think, too, how does this tie in with doing the daily readings and making sure we're practicing the other sacraments? Because doesn't this all work together?
Of course, yeah. You know, it's the sacrament of sacraments, the Holy Eucharist, and it is source and summit of the mm-hmm. Christian life, and that implies an integrated whole here. And I do think, you know, the more we're used to gazing upon the Lord Jesus in the Eucharist and receiving his gaze back at us, it's kind of a greenhouse in the Adoration Chapel to grow in faith, hope, and charity. And the more that we learn to find Jesus' hidden presence there in the Eucharist, the more as we go forth from the chapel, we're able to find his hidden presence, you know, in other ways. You know, Romans 1, you know, creation 2 proclaims the glory of God. There's a certain glimpse of God we can get through created things, the human person. And so there are sort of like three hidden presences of God. Hidden in Christ in the Eucharist, hidden in our neighbor, and then hidden in the depths of our soul. You might think of Elizabeth of the Trinity and the indwelling Trinity. Mm-hmm. And as we grow in one of those, you also grow in the others. And that's what I love about the Missionaries of Charity. They kind of lean into the difficulties here, finding Jesus in the distressing disguise of the poorest of the poor, where you might think you would least likely find him, to like enter those situations with faith. And Eucharistic adoration helps you to do that. So your whole life, everything becomes theophany, and you begin to live more in mindful of God's presence and living forth from the love he's pouring into your heart.
Yeah. I wish there would be more people investigating or at least finding out about Eucharistic miracles, because once you start reading about the Eucharistic miracles, if you had the opportunity to see them, and being in Italy, we've been blessed in leading tours and whatnot, and pilgrimages, I've been to many of them. And it's just, it's so incredible. It is hard to wrap your mind, it's hard to wrap your mind around the Eucharist, which is what, you know, we say in the prayers. But Father Jesse, what do you think about helping people to really make, I mean, St. Carlo Acutis made it so easy for us now to look up Eucharistic miracles, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I recently was doing a mission preaching to a big youth night, and I was, you know, sharing some of the Eucharistic miracles. And, you know, I was amazed, you know, at how it just really kind of can be an instrument of the Holy Spirit, that kind of preaching, to like aliven the faith in the Holy Eucharist. And, you know, recently I it was sort of a Eucharistic miracle, but in a different context, in context of our book. Before coming out here, I had like kind of an emergency baptism, and this young girl was coming into the church to be the baptism. She was being helped into the church by two people, and it looked like she had MS, that kind of thing, and just struggling. And she's like, I need to speak to you. And afterwards, after the baptism, she said, you know, I was in the hospital waiting on my diagnosis, trying to figure out what's going on in my body, thinking of my children. And now this is someone who would be more in the New Age scene, you know, not really. And she's like, I was in the hostel room, and I the Eucharist appeared to me in a vision and started to glow. And then the very next day, her dad gave her our book. And and he had no clue what his daughter experienced the day before. And she said the book just changed her life, and she's met Christ. And now,
wow.
like, and she's an artist. She actually painted what she saw. And it's this beautiful, like, you know, like almost in a garden with like a golden staircase and then the Eucharist glowing. But she knew it was the Eucharist when she saw it. It wasn't like the sun. She knew. And then, yeah, so it was just amazing, you know, and to, it was just like, wow. You know, so there are those kind of miracles, too, of people experiencing the Eucharist in that, or the Lord's doing stuff like that. To wake up people's minds.
Yeah, amen to that. What a story. What a godsend that was. Write that one down. Might be another book in there, gentlemen. What do you think? Thank you so much, Father Ignatius J. Schweitzer and Father Jesse Mango. Thank you so much. Your beautiful book, How to Be His, a 33-day dedication to our Eucharistic Jesus. We'll be right back. From Sophia Press, by the way. We'll be right back. That was so beautiful. I could have talked to them forever. But they are going to be on Father Mitch Live tonight, so make sure you tune in for that. Appreciate the great work of two wonderful priests. It's so neat how God brought them together. It's just awesome. What's coming up tomorrow? Well, somebody named Dr. Ray Guarendi, have you heard of him? Yeah, he's joining us. So there is a new report coming out about childhood well-being in decline since the pandemic. But then there was also some other stories, and we're actually having our editorial meeting after the show, that came out. And I really wanted to talk to Dr. Ray about those. I don't know if we'll bring him back next week, if we'll talk about both tomorrow. We'll see. It's live radio. You never know, as Rosie used to say. And of course, it's a Thursday, and that means our very own Father Mitch Pacwa, who just celebrated, yay, 50 years of the priesthood. He had a big celebration last week. God love him. What a gift he is to the church. So he'll be with us to talk culture, cultural connections, and then we're also going to be speaking with, wait, there's more, Camille Pauly is the co-founder of Healing the Culture, and we're going to be talking about different efforts that are going on there, expansion of digital access to their program in terms of what they're doing to make a difference. So a lot of exciting things to discuss. And just a reminder, if you could say some prayers for the release of my latest book, which is all about St. Francis in the year of St. Francis, I would greatly appreciate it. Just came out yesterday, Italy's Shrines and Wonders, Volume 2. Talk to you tomorrow on a Thursday. God bless you. Ciao, ciao.